Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcasts, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I am inclined to believe that you are a hater. It's that time of week where we do an interview. And joining us, she is the author of I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying. Did I get that contradictory sentence correct?
Yes, you did.
Whew, there we go. check out the book. Her name is Bossy Igpe. And I think if you know me, I don't really come on here very often with a whole lot of recommendations for you guys. I'm going to tell you something that's good is because I sincerely and legitimately believe that. And I thought this book was like a legitimate masterpiece. Like as a consumer for me, one, in terms of just kind of the human elements and picking up what was in there and giving me a different look at the world. And then also for me as someone who produces content, I was like, yo, I can't write this. I have no ability to do something this well and this thoroughly. And the sentences just all felt, everything just felt so precise and everything was just so well done. And I was just sitting there like, this is at once humbling and enlightening. So, you know, thanks for putting me in touch with where my ego needs to be. I think it's part of it I'd go with.
Thank you for that. That was not my intention, but I appreciate that. I really do.
No, you're humbling the rest of us. That's cool. That's what these things are supposed to be, though. Like, you do good work, and people who would like to think that they're capable of doing good work should be able to see it and be like, oh, okay, I don't know if I can do that.
I didn't want to do that, but I'm glad though, because I have a lot of respect for you and respect for what you do. Like I told you, my brothers are probably somewhere in their cars screaming that I'm on here, but yeah, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Now for you, and I'll get into it a little bit with people about just what's going on with the book and why specifically I wanted you on this year's sports podcast, but what was the process like for you of just writing the book?
It was difficult. The book that I intended to write was not this book. I intended to write something more motivational, more stereotypically self-helpy, because I thought that's what people wanted from me. I didn't think they wanted the real what this thing feels like. But in 2016, I had one of the worst depressive episodes of my life, and I was writing this book at the same time. So it was very difficult for me to get into this self-help motivational space. On the other side, I was writing these letters and these essays and these notes for my friends and my family to explain exactly what it is that I was going through. And there was a moment where it clicked that I realized that this thing that I was doing privately was the actual book, which is why so much of it felt real time, because I was writing a lot of it in real time.
Now, how comfortable were you with the idea when you thought you were going to do something that was more motivational and self-helpy? Like, how comfortable were you with the idea? Because the thought to me of, like, I'm going to write a book to tell you how you can do these things better. Like, I don't know if I know that.
I know I didn't know that. But I thought that's what people wanted.
Right.
It's actually the book that we sold. So everyone was really excited because I have this, you know, a spoken word poet. That's how people know me. Mental health advocate. That's how people know me. I thought that's what they wanted. I wanted to sort of, you know, give this little insight about what it feels like to go through different things, but then also what it feels like to get over those things, because I didn't want to leave people kind of just depressed and confused. And the only way I knew to do that was to have some sort of platitude at the end and, you know, and now you can make it too. And then I was thinking, I was like, where am I? Like, make it where? And the conversation about it being an ongoing process for me, the fact that I'm always going to be someone who has to consider her mental health at every stage of my life, I felt like that was more important to say to people rather than giving them this idea that if they didn't have these platitudes and nice things to say at the end of it, that their life somehow didn't mean as much. And I didn't want that to be the ending of it.
Yeah, I love people who use the word platitude because that means they hate platitudes as much as I do.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I feel like that's a word you only learn to deploy to talk badly about other people.
Exactly.
Who use them.
Exactly. Because people who like them don't use the word. They say things like, positive energy and like that. Yeah.
The other thing with platitudes also is, and the key part about a notion of a platitude is the person really thinks they hit you with something,
mm-hmm.
right? Like they hit you in the end. They're like, and you know what it is? Early bird gets the worm.
like you've never heard it before.
Yeah. Like I came around all of this just to get to the early bird gets the worm.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So for those who are unfamiliar with the book, how would you describe the experiences that you chronicle?
It's difficult to say because there's so much in the book. So it's not just about mental health. It's about family. It's about relationships. It's about understanding the things that you try so hard to hide from people. I think that's the main thing. I think it's uncovering the layers, that we've put on ourselves in order to mask what we're really going through. And I wanted this book to be both a mirror and a window, a mirror for people to see themselves and understand that they're not alone in the things that they go through. And then a window for people to see other folks, folks that they don't like very much, folks that they think have an attitude, folks that they think that are lazy or irresponsible or have some sort of personality thing that they deem negative. Just a window into seeing that there are other things going on that affect the ways in which people behave, that we will never understand, you know?
Yeah. Now for you, what is the process like of submitting these very personal things to someone to have them edit them? Because I think that for people who have never been in either a magazine writing process or even a book proposal writing process, like the way I describe it, and part of why writing a book is just such a daunting process for me, is you write something that is the best that you thought that you were capable of doing, and you are 10 drafts away on what that is to what is actually like the best that you can do, and somebody hacking to death what you're doing. And it seems to me it's one thing when somebody's hacking just like your work and something intellectually that you have put together. It's another thing when you are, here is my bare naked soul, and they're like, okay, well, let me tell you how to make this better.
Well, the thing is, you want it to be better.
Right.
You know, like, you don't want to put trash out there. And I think that, and I'm going to, I've read your work, so I don't think that you would have 10 drafts of it. I think that the one thing that I was very appreciative of my editor was that she saw when I was hiding. She saw when I was writing something in order to avoid writing something else. So she wouldn't say, this is trash. She would say, you know, what are you trying to avoid saying? Like, say that, and then we'll talk about whether or not it's going to go into the final draft. So what I had to do was give myself permission to write the worst, write the rawest, write the most uncomfortable in order to get to what it is that I actually wanted to say. Because then a good editor's mission is not to hack away at you and make you feel defeated when you walk away. They want you to walk away feeling as though you have the tools to go back and make this thing even better, like polish it, basically. Because the thing is, I think that with the exception of like the celebrity memoir, the celebrity kind of thing, nobody who wants to write a book kind of walks in thinking that it's going to be terrible. They have like an inkling somewhere that it's going to be good, right? And they want it to be as good as possible. And that's where the editor comes in. And there are things that I really liked that she took out. She was like, this is great, but it has nothing to do with anything that we're talking about. So I just, you know, cut that stuff out, put it in a folder somewhere. And I'm like, maybe later some other book will want it, you know?
Right. Now, was there anything for you that was particularly difficult to, what the editor said, this is what you're avoiding saying? Was there anything that you were just really like, no, I'm not going to do that, and then eventually came back around on?
Yeah, there were plenty of things. There was stuff about my family that I was very hesitant to write about. Things about, like, you know, relationships that I was very hesitant to write about. But I was also very firm in that if there was something that I was very, very clear, I do not want to talk about this, and I will write everything but that, then that didn't need to go in there. Because it's not about me being uncomfortable. It's not about me getting to the point where I'm so uncomfortable with this thing that I wrote that I don't even want to talk about it. So I had to make sure that and that's part of like the whole mental health training and boundaries. I had to be very clear about how far I was willing to go and how far I was willing to expose myself and other people. So even this book that feels very raw and vulnerable and huge, there's a good 62%, I just made that up. There's a good portion of it that didn't go into this book because I didn't want it in there. So the stuff, I had to make sure that the stuff that was in the book was as clear and as sharp and as I hesitate to say powerful, but like as impactful as it possibly could be, because I knew that there were other things that a weaker book would have in it that would make it way more vulnerable. And I wasn't interested in just sitting there and skinning myself for people. That wasn't the point of it. And I don't think that I had the luxury of doing that as a black woman, as an immigrant, as somebody who loves the people around them. And I didn't want to hurt anybody. And that was the forefront of my mind.
So when you say the luxury, you're talking specifically about how the people that were involved in these parts of your life would be affected by them being publicized.
Yes. Yeah. I was very careful not to speak about people past the way that their lives intersected with mine. So I didn't want to go into like other people's family dynamics, and those family dynamics would explain the way that their lives, you know, the way that they behave when they're with me. But that's not my business. That's not my story to tell. So I didn't want to tell anybody else's story. I was very, very clear that I was telling my own story. And yes, sometimes the way somebody's life, you know, intersected with mine wasn't in a positive way, but I wanted to be sure that I was clear that it was the way that it affected me, not the person that they actually were.
Yeah, that was something I was curious about too, because I know a mutual friend of ours, Michael Arsenault, when he wrote his book, I was very curious about how you make the decision of what to share and what not to share when it involves other people. So a lot of his stuff was about family, and it's like, okay, this is still your family though, right? So like, how do you decide what you're going to put in and where the lines are? I've always found that to be an interesting thing, because you're right, it's not your place to tell somebody else's story. Although some people really love to write books and do that exact thing.
They do. And I don't understand it. Like, they'll go through I don't know if you watch Queen Sugar, but there's this whole thing where people are writing in detail about other people. And I just don't think that's fair. And for me, and Michael and I speak about this often, I edited towards kindness. So if I could find some little speck of empathy that I could find for that person, I was going to write towards that. Still tell the truth about what it is that I experienced with them, but tried as much as possible to also be very clear about the positive things that I experienced with them as well. And if there was, you know, stuff that I wrote about, you know, family specifically, I love my family. So if there were things that in the notes from my editor that said, oh my God, this is terrible, I can't believe that happened, I went back and looked at that and made sure that I could go back and say, okay, let me add some layers to it so that you know that there are more to these people than just these terrible things that you think that they did. Because I don't think that anyone is purely terrible. The same way I don't think anybody's purely wonderful. You know, I wanted people to have dimensions as much as possible.
Yeah, and it, like, your self-awareness kind of comes through in the writing, and it stands out in what you're saying here. And I guess I wonder how self-awareness goes. Like, when you know that what you're giving is your interpretation of it, I imagine that with a measure of self-awareness, that informs that kindness that you'd have toward other people, knowing that what I'm seeing, I understand, is not necessarily like the total sum of all of this.
Yeah, yeah. Specifically because I know my journey, and I know that there are things that happened in my life that affect the way that I would be a partner, a parent, a sibling, all those things. So I have to also consider that there are things that happen in other people's lives that affect the way that they parent, the way they partner, and the way that, you know, they do anything in their lives. So my level of self-awareness gave me the grace to give that to other people and make sure that I wasn't vilifying anyone. That was really important to me. I didn't want to vilify anything or anyone or any of the experiences.
Yeah, I think kindness is an interesting like concept to deal with when discussing this, at least for me, because I felt that part of it as a reader who does not directly like personally relate to the content in a first person sort of way was giving a glimpse into other people. And part of why I wanted to have you on here is like, Gabe could tell you this and other people, I'm trying to get out of the habit of using the blanket term crazy. It's just kind of a general thing that comes up. It's like, yo, that's crazy. Oh, okay, well, maybe we're not supposed to do that. Because that, I think, is an easy way a lot of us to dismiss things that are legitimate, like mental health issues. And we're not even, and when we do that, we're not even saying that we're not entertaining the possibility of a mental health issue. We are specifically saying, hey, you know, this person seems to have some sort of issue, and just kind of like being dismissive about it. Yeah. And where I found myself being very interested, like personally, as I read it, was how to engage with people who have some of these struggles, whether they realize they have them or not. And I was just wondering, for you, when you have the readers of this book, is that something that you wanted them to come away with? Or like, how much of a concern do you have when you write something like this about what you want people to feel or see or read?
I'm very concerned, because that's the point of it. The point of, for me, the point of writing isn't just to, again, expose myself and expose my family and my friends and their secrets and then walk away from it. I wanted people to understand, because I wanted people to understand me. There are things that I have done that I am not proud of. There are things that exist in my life that I want people to have an understanding of where I got to, how I got to that point. So I wanted that to be, again, to open up these chambers of empathy that aren't predicated on people feeling sorry or pity. I wanted just a blanket understanding. So when you talk about, especially from like a sports aspect, my friends, you know, laugh at me often because I'll hear a story and they're like, oh my God, this story is so crazy. This guy did da, 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 da. And I'm like, that sounds manic. That sounds very manic. That sounds depressive. That sounds like anxiety. Like, you know, I'm not great with sports, but there's a basketball player that people like meme all the time. Kawhi?
Yes, Kawhi.
Yes. And so I see that, and I don't know, I'm not going to give anybody a diagnosis, but I'm like, this sounds like he's anxious. Like, he doesn't want to talk to people. Like, it's not like he's being standoffish or being quirky. It's like, I recognize having to be a public person, and your part of your job is to speak to people, but then also knowing that that's not your personality. There's something that kind of prevents and puts a block up. And I look at things like that. I look at that when it comes to Kanye. I look at it when it comes to a lot of people. It's not an excuse for behavior, but it is a reason. And I want people to understand the difference between excuses and reasons. Reasons explain and excuses dismiss.
Yeah, and that's part of why that's a specific thing I wanted to talk to you about, like as it relates to your book and the kind of things that we typically do here, is that one right there. Because I have to say, our broadening awareness and empathy in our society towards people with mental health issues is really kind of bad for business over here. Because a lot of the things that we're now aware of are things that we used to just be able to get on here and light up and go on with. So we got to do an Antonio Brown who has been doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And my question repeatedly has been, dude, are you okay?
Yeah.
Right? And in a way, I'm kind of being jokey, except for the fact that I'm seriously like, hey, man, really, like, dude, are you okay?
Yeah.
But I don't have any tools to evaluate this sort of thing. So when we get to our right or wrong questions, it's still like, yo, okay, but you're wilding out right now.
Yeah.
But we don't know what to do with that if it's informed almost by an empathy. We know what to do with it in our business if it has a sociopathic element that allows us to become some voice at the top to be like, hey, you down there, you are doing this thing wrong. Yeah. If I got to treat them like people, we don't always know what to do there.
Yeah, well, I think that the conversation is not the bad part. Like, you can discuss the fact that somebody's wild, and you can right. have that conversation. You can say, you know, this dude did some like wild stuff, and you can talk about that. I think where it becomes problematic is when the next statement is then like, you know, so F them, like throw them away. Like, that's the end of it. You don't always, I think it's human nature to discuss stuff that doesn't make sense. That's human nature. So having the conversation is not the problem. The problem is how you treat the person. The problem is how you treat the people, you know, in your lives who you recognize having those same, you know, behavior or patterns. So, like when you were talking about just now about, you know, not saying things are blanket crazy, people have that conversation with me a lot. Like, do you say different things? Like, what language do I use? I'm less concerned about language and more concerned about behavior. So you can use whatever words you want. You can say crazy. You can say this is insane. It's vernacular. It's slang. But how are you treating somebody who you actually believe has those symptoms? Like, what are you actually doing? What are you saying to their face? Like, you can't call me crazy because, right, you know, I've got a diagnosis. But you can say something broader is crazy. That's my personal opinion. I want to change the way people behave towards others, not the language that they use. I'm not interested in policing that.
Right. See, the language part gets interesting for me, and where I try to be conscientious of it is not like what I'm saying about Antonio Brown in this instance as much as someone who may see themselves in Antonio Brown and has not spoken about these matters, and then they hear me say that they are crazy.
Right.
Right? Like that becomes kind of sort of my concern, because I felt like, for the book, I imagine for a lot of people, it may have been a window into themselves, whether they realized it was going to be that in the first place. And it makes me think, like, how many people who hear us talk about these people are actually thinking that we are talking about them?
Yeah.
You know, like that's the part that kind of worries me there as much as anything else.
That's true, because, again, going back, like there are conversations that people have about people like Antonio Brown and I keep bringing up Kanye, but the way that they speak about them, I find hurtful, because they're not talking about, you know, they think they're talking in a very specific term about these people, but the language used is so broad that it affects the people that they don't even know who are dealing with certain things. And I think that's an issue, because it's hurtful to hear someone say, to be dismissive of the behavior and say, well, they're just arrogant, or they're just, you know, selfish, or there are just all these different, you know, negative character traits that nobody wants to be associated with, and not understanding that there are people in your lives who are struggling with this. They're not living with it. They're not dealing with it. They're struggling, and hearing you speak about them in that way, makes the struggle even more, because now you don't want to get help because
right.
you don't want that label. So I understand it in that aspect.
Yeah, and Kanye, I think, becomes an interesting point, because I feel like on a macro level, some of what he's dealing with is living out something that people fear on a micro level, which is Kanye, I think, part of why so many people react so viscerally to the things he does is because he has disappointed them.
Yeah.
Right? Like they had ascribed, and granted, all this, a lot of this stuff was already present, right?
Yeah.
Like if you go, like when you jump back now and go look at 2004 Kanye, it's like when you go back and watch The Usual Suspects, it's like, oh, there's the gold lighter.
Yes.
Right? Like that was Kaiser Sose. It was directly in our face the whole time.
Yeah.
But I think, and this is kind of, I don't want to say it's his fault that people feel disappointed by him, because he did try to put himself in a place to where, you know, to be viewed in that way. But I think he has disappointed people, which then makes them angrier in the way they respond to him, to be from a place almost of hurt themselves. And I feel like for a lot of people in their regular lives, right, like that seems to be the I would think is a concern for a lot of them. And I felt like to a degree was kind of a tone in your book, is the idea of feeling like you disappointed those people, you know, and that makes the Kanye thing to me. I think that's the next level of that with him, is he's living a lot of people's struggle, but there is hardly anyone that I've seen that's willing to come in public and be like, hey, Kanye, I see what you're going through and I know what that is.
Yeah, I think people, that comes with the stigma, right? Like you feel like calling people out or not calling them out, but being empathetic in that way and saying, I see what you're going through. People don't want that to happen, because then you're putting a label on them. And it gets really frustrating to me, especially on social media, where people say, well, you can't armchair diagnose. You're not a doctor. You don't know what people did. And I'm like, well, I'm not a doctor, but if I see your leg bent in a way that is unnatural,
right,
I can point out, I don't know what kind of fracture it is. I don't know how bad the fracture it is, but I know that your leg is not supposed to bend in that direction. I can call that,
right,
you know, but with mental health, because of the stigma, people think they're doing a good thing by not diagnosing, but they're doing not a bad thing, but they're doing the very opposite of that. They're now stigmatizing it in a way that it's not natural to have the conversations necessary to point out the things that people are doing, because you don't want to put that label on them. But by not putting the label on them, you're stigmatizing them.
Right.
It's a, you know, big roundabout kind of thing, but how it exists.
Yeah, and in sports, it becomes interesting, depending on the sport, like especially in football, right, where I would make the anecdote, like the hypothesis, I would put it out there, that we probably got more people fighting through mental health issues in football than we have in these other sports.
Absolutely.
The difference between football and most other things, though, is they seem to have found ways and many times to channel these mental health things into something that is legitimately positive and lucrative, mm-hmm. right? Because playing football is crazy. Like the basic idea that this, you're going to go out here and do this, this is a crazy thing for you to do. There are going to be some crazy people who are out here doing it. And some of them, I think the people around them believe that if they weren't so crazy, they wouldn't be so good at this, and they might be right.
Yeah.
And like, my job is to run directly into people. If I start getting sane, man, I ain't gonna do this no more.
Yeah.
This isn't what sane people do.
Yeah. And then, when you think about the, again, I'm not like big on sports, but I have family, and the guy who quit, like in the middle of the
Monte Davis did
last year.
He was
just like, all right, well, you know, I'm done. And people were acting like that was the crazy part. Like him making the decision not to do a thing that was harmful to him became, you know, and I think when it comes to football or when it comes to sports, people project so much onto the players that I would never quit a job that paid me X amount of $1 million. But it's like, okay, but if it's harmful to you physically and emotionally and mentally, the quitting isn't the crazy part. The staying is.
Right.
You know, but I think that people don't. And what I hope that the book did was give some people some insight into why people make the decisions that they do, and try to avoid or disabuse them of this notion that you can just project yourself onto people. If I were Kanye, if I were Antonio Brown, if I were these people, I wouldn't. But you're also not living in their brains and the ways that their brains operate. You don't know what that is.
We'll be back in a minute with more with Bossy Ikpe, but first, after hearing me talk about ButcherBox for months, if you haven't taken advantage of their amazing offers, you need to listen up. Every month, ButcherBox delivers humanely raised, 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon directly to your door. You choose from 4 curated boxes or customize your own box with all your favorite cuts. And with free shipping, ButcherBox makes getting high-quality meat with no added hormones or antibiotics easier than ever. Last box I had some bacon, had some pork chops, had some beef. Really liked the pork chops. Put them on the grill. It was fantastic. Now, if that's not for you, ButcherBox has a ton of awesome recipes and resources on their website that'll help you bring out all the flavors of each cut of meat you get from ButcherBox. Time is running out to get $20 off your first box plus free ground beef for the life of your subscription when you sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani. Don't miss out on this amazing offer. In addition to all the great meat you get, ButcherBox is knocking $20 off your first box and throwing in 2 pounds of free ground beef in every box for the life of your subscription when you sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani. ButcherBox.com/Bomani. Now, what's it been like for you after sharing these things, right? Because I imagine there's some people who were aware of you or knew you to a degree who now know you far more intimately than they did, but they still don't, like, actually know you.
Yeah. It's been a lot. Actually, the past couple of days, I've had, like, you know, I've had to check myself and my boundaries because people put a lot on me. You know, I'll have, like, a book event and then the signing line will take 2 hours because people don't just want a book signed and then leave. They want to sit and they want to talk about chapter, you know, 7, and they want to have these conversations about themselves and their families. And I'm open to that because that's what I did. That's the table I laid out. So I can't pull back from that. But I also have to be very careful about the way that I allow folks to own what I've done. You own the book. You bought that. You have the book. But you don't own me. And I have to be very clear about that. The people who know me, my friends, one thing that I didn't consider was how much guilt they'd feel, from the past. Like, you know, we were roommates in 2002 and I didn't know that this thing was happening. And, I didn't want that. But I understand now why that would be something that would come up. But when it comes to people who don't know me, I don't want to distance myself from them because I wrote a book that was pulling people in, but I also have to be very careful about how much I allow myself to keep visiting those things over and over again, because I'm in a space now where, I would never go through those things again because I'm much healthier than I was then.
You know, that's a part that I really hadn't thought so much about is I imagine I thought about the idea of reliving the book, you know, reliving those experiences through writing, but I hadn't thought about then reliving it through the interpretations of the people who were there. And as I have told people recently, I had never felt like I'd had this problem before, but things that you talk about, like the book signing line, now give me an anxiety that I never had before. I did something about a couple months ago and there were people coming from 3 different directions and I made up a lie and ran away and went out the back door and me and my brother went and got dinner.
That's what you gotta do.
I did, this has never happened before, but I'm standing there and I'm just like freaking out at that. And those aren't people who want to tell me like the depths of their souls. They want to tell me that they like it when I talk about people getting the chain snatched off, right? Like that has to be a much different experience for you in these things because you're hitting people in such a personal place and the best way that they can show their appreciation is to take you into something fairly heavy.
Yeah. And the thing is I've made that decision. Like I know walking in that this is what's going to happen. So for me, this is a choice that I've made. I've decided, yes, I'm going to sit with these people. I'm going to have these conversations. Afterwards, I'm going to go back to my hotel and I'm going to order room service and I'm going to watch dumb YouTube videos until I fall asleep. That's how I do that. I don't think everyone has to do that. I have, you know, friends, we have mutual friends who have been at these events and they'll be the ones to be like, 30 seconds, it's time to pull her away, you know, and they do that for me because they know that I won't be able to do that. But, you know, I don't think everybody has to do that. Sign the book and bounce. And I'm also very clear, during the things I say, I'm not going to write to, you know, Auntie, whoever, thank you. I'm not going to do that because that takes up space in my brain that I could be using. I'll sign your book. I'll talk to you. We'll take photos. I'll do that. But I have to erect different kinds of boundaries to make sure that I'm okay, you know.
Now, how comfortable are you with the ways now, I think, you know, like I call this thing a masterpiece and I absolutely mean that, but you're going to have a whole lot of people now where what you mean to them is more than just a person who wrote a book that they really enjoyed. Is that something that you had thought about beforehand?
In what way?
Well, I guess I could imagine that for some people, especially to whom this speaks very, very closely to them, that it's not just a book. Like you are now they peoples. You know what I mean? like the role that you now play, even if they never consume anything else that you do, that you now play in their lives is probably a pretty substantial one.
Yeah, I'm very hesitant to sort of accept standing. Mm-hmm. And I'm very clear about that, which is another reason why I want to sit and talk to people. Like, it's a very real thing that I'm doing. I don't want you to project your Oprah fantasies onto me, because I'm not. I'm very real in that, and very clear that that's not what I want, but I understand why it exists. And I'm also hopeful that because it exists, other people will write books like that so that it's not just, I'm going to sit here and say that I'm the only one who's done this. I'm not. But right now, my encouragement is for people to, one of the best compliments is like, it made me want to write, and I wanted to write, you know, other things that I was going through. Fantastic. Go write, publish. Like, I want people to feel seen, and I don't want them to just see me. There are things in the book that I took out, like the whole, like I went through this whole deaf poetry life, and I took that stuff out of the book because it made it very specifically about me. People can't relate to, you know, moving to New York, you know, dropping out of school, moving to New York and doing all these things. I didn't want that to be the story. I wanted the emotional stuff to be the, what they could relate to, and anybody could feel that. Anyone can go through that. So it's not just on me to be the one that's like the beacon of light and hope, but I do want people to have some light and hope at the end of it.
That's interesting. I would actually think that the moving to do that sort of thing would actually be among some more relatable stuff, right? Like, there's a reason why you got all these movies and stuff about people deciding they're just going up and go to New York and to do these things. Like, I would think that people could relate to that even if they didn't necessarily do it, but like the desire to do that.
Well, I mean, the desire to do it was very much motivated by mania. Like, I literally walked out of class. I went to the University of Maryland, Baltimore, walked out of class, called my friend, do you want to go to New York for a weekend, and ended up staying for 7 years. That's not normal. That's not normal behavior, but it would be too much of a fantasy. It seems like the success story. Wow, you know, you dropped everything and then you built this life for yourself. I didn't want that to be the story. I wanted people to see the way that these things show up in ways that aren't as glamorous and don't end in that positive of a note, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's interesting though hearing you say that, because it then takes me to think about another element of that. And I guess this is because it probably speaks to me a little more personally, which is somewhat of the difficulty of the things you may be struggling with, why it appears to be success to everybody else, which I imagine had to be a struggle for you in the present and looking back at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was the worst times of my life was when I appeared the most successful. I was, you know, in my 20s, I was traveling the world, traveling all over the place. I was on TV. I was, you know, on stage every night. I was doing the things, making money, doing the things that people didn't realize could be a job. And I was dying. Like, I was suffering. It was the worst time of my life. But people don't want to hear that you're suffering when you're doing something that they, we spoke about it just now. People don't want to hear that you're suffering when you're doing something that they wish that they could do. They don't want to hear that. So that's another reason why I didn't want that to be the story. Like, oh, poor you. You're making how much money doing nothing. You know, I feel so bad for you. I didn't want that.
Oh, no, let me tell you, that's part of why rich people got so many therapists, man, because ain't nobody else trying to hear this noise from you. Like this is like, well, you're da, da, da. Like, I was talking to a friend about something I was dealing with once where I was just a little tired of like recognition and stuff like that, because it really had become an anxious sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I was explaining that, and the response I got was, well, you're famous. And my response to that was, that's what I'm complaining about, man. Like, this is the thing that you have. And so I imagine it's got to be doubly frustrating when you're doing the kind of fame that don't necessarily pay money.
Yeah.
You know, so you deal with every other real life part of it that comes up. And then people are like, well, what are you talking about? You're in an insert place here.
Well, the thing is when people are like, oh, poor you, you're famous. But like, imagine you're sitting there minding your business at dinner and a random person, like, people get upset when people bump into them on the train. So imagine someone bumping into you every, like, almost every day, you know, multiple times a day, how frustrating that is. Just because you get a paycheck doesn't make it less frustrating. And this idea that money is some sort of protective bubble, and it can be, but it doesn't protect you from the things, the annoyances that bother other people. It magnifies it. And for people not to understand that, I think is a willful ignorance. And a lot of the book is about, you know, removing that willful ignorance. You can't say, I don't know anybody who because now you know what it looks like, and you can, and if you see somebody going through something and you make the choice to still be a jerk to them, then that's on you. It's not on that person.
Yeah, there's a certain measure of struggle that I think is like randomly distributed across the population, right? Like there's certain external factors that make struggle more likely. Like if your money's funny, mm-hmm. you're going to probably struggle more. You're going to be more stressed. It's going to probably exacerbate different things that you feel already. But yeah. I feel like if we look around the world, what you're going to have to deal with, it could be anybody. It could be anything. And it's not even necessarily like I guess I'm not thinking or advocating the idea that you assume that everybody around you might have something wrong with them. But you do kind of have to consider the possibility of the things that are just beyond people's control. And yeah. I do wonder with our current society, the difficulty I have is figuring out the balance between acknowledging what is beyond people's control and being like, okay, but you're tripping right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that it would be ridiculous to think that people would be 100% conscientious all the time. I don't think that's realistic. But I do think that it, let's take social media, for instance. There are people who get on Twitter every day just to talk crap about other people and jump into their mentions and go off on them. Don't do that. You know what I mean? Like that's a thing that you don't have to do. But if you're having a conversation personally about somebody, you know, if there are people having, you know, breakfast or lunch right now, having conversations about me, I don't care. When you jump into my mentions, when you start emailing me, when you start having those conversations to me, that's a problem. So I'm not going to fault anybody for wanting to talk about other people and talk about the things that they go through. It's when you bring it to them that's a problem.
Social media is a fascinating petri dish of all this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. It is. I've always said its greatest benefit has been the ability to eavesdrop and see what else is going on with the rest of the world. Now, part of the problem is it's a lot of people out here that felt like they were alone, and it would be better if they still thought.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Cause now they've got community.
Yes.
They got community. So now whatever fool thing you think.
Yes.
Whatever dumb thing you think, you've got at least 1,000 people who believe that same thing. So now you think you're right.
Right. And it seems like so much more. Like I got a better glimpse into just the idea of how you can have a couple people and it'll make you think that the world is like in the same thing. Cause like when I hear people talk about something will happen, they'll send something and it goes around more than they're accustomed to. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, my mentions are destroyed. And then I'll go look in there and I'll be like, oh, this isn't destruction. Like,
right.
This isn't even close to what it is. But when I hear that, it makes me realize you get 5 people to hit you back and say you like something, you know, they like something that you said or whatever it is. And suddenly you have a cross section of the universe that tells you that people, right? Cause that's what we do on social media is like the broad people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people out here saying this, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how many people? People, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's all the people, but I am fascinated in watching though and seeing how many people, like, I don't want to say they're telling on themselves because that feels unfair, but given a running tally of ourselves, in a way, I wonder how often we go back and look at it and be like, whoa, boy, you know, I was kind of telling a tale I did not know that I was saying.
Yeah. I had to learn to do that. I said something a couple of days ago, and I recognized that I said it because I was in a bad mood. And I made this blanket statement and I went back and I apologized and then I deleted it. And I think a lot of people would benefit from going back, looking at it, apologizing and deleting it. But folks will stand firm in that thing, especially if it's getting retweets, especially if it's getting likes and you know that. That's not, you shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, it's a journal and a megaphone for people all at one time. Like
absolutely.
If you are not a visible person, you can at once feel like you are saying something to nothing, to nobody.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, be perfectly aware that you are saying it to the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it becomes a tricky thing, but I am interested in like kind of how people are mad, right? Like
yeah.
I think this is a societally a time that is generating a certain measure of anger. Man, we take it out on person with 173 followers.
Yeah.
Don't honestly, I don't know how that person didn't realize what's going to happen to them when they do that.
Yeah.
Cause like who's the, I want to do a study on that. Who's the original person that finds the original idiot that becomes the day for everybody? Just
yeah.
a cascade.
And I look at that too. Like I'll see people, like quote tweet and they're going in and then like all of Black Twitter finds it and then all of, you know, sports Twitter finds it and they're going in on this person. And then I go back to the tweet and then I look at the other stuff that they've said and I was like, why did you give this person this platform? Like either they didn't know what they were saying or you can think, okay, at the end of it, why do you need to respond?
Yeah.
Like why did you need to say anything? Especially if other people have said it. joining in and using, you know, your thousands and hundreds of thousands of followers to also put yourself, you know, in their mentions. Like, what's the point?
Yeah, because I used to do it, but I really overwhelmingly. Yeah. I was trying to be funny.
Yeah.
Right? Now,
yeah.
That doesn't justify it necessarily, but I do know, like, why was I doing this? I never really felt like I was purging anger, which I may have been doing, right?
Yeah.
And, like, not realized it. But I was like, okay, I have something clever to say about this. They ain't out here being clever, man. They just out here killing these people.
Exactly. Like, I understand getting jokes off. I like to joke. Like, getting the jokes off, I respect that. I understand that. But for me, it's when people are just being cruel. Like, they're just being cruel to be cruel. And you know when you're just being cruel. You know when that's happening. And to not take a moment to consider what that is. And again, for me, going through and seeing I am in a bad mood. Anything that comes across my path today is going to get it. And being aware enough to say, because I know that, I'm just going to ignore the things that come across my path that I know are going to get it.
Yeah, I had to stop. For me, I had to stop. Basically, because I was going at people that were in my mentions. Like, historically, that's I ain't looking for that many people. They've been kind enough to bring it directly to my doorstep. Yeah, no, you know, I guess I can let some of these slide too. Yeah,
I mean, some of it you can't let slide because you have to, you know, you have to defend yourself or you have to, correct people who are determined to get you wrong.
Right.
But I think that after the first time, same person, maybe respond, and then, okay, now we're going to 3, 4, 5 times. This person is still coming at me. Mute and move on.
Yeah.
Because it's just better for you.
Yeah, I think that's the big part is I was like, yo, man, this does not look fun. I have cut out a lot of the back clapping from my life. And I don't know if it's made me happier. I don't know if I'm happier as a result. I'm not sure. But I do have to say, I don't miss it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Have you ever had something happen on Twitter that even after you put your phone down and walked away, you're still thinking about it. You're still talking about it.
Yeah, no, I'm usually pretty good at like it being in a moment.
Good.
And then kind of like that was my thing generally. Cause I recognized like I was on Twitter when I was quote unquote nobody. And so I could watch incrementally the way people treated me differently as the exposure. So to me, it became a fascination.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. This is what happens when you get on television. Like people stop thinking you're a person. You just become the guy on the screen. It was like, oh, okay, I see what this is. So I really was just kind of like, huh, I'm doing the exact same thing that I used to do and nobody cared about, but now people are mad. It's possible, just possible, that this is not about me, right?
Yeah.
So like they don't hit my self-esteem in that way necessarily, but I did have to realize that I was contributing to probably a overall unhealthy sort of culture in that stuff, because I know why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
That is not necessarily why all these other people are out here doing this. And then it's like, okay, I am a quote unquote somebody, right? So now I am doing something harsh to one person. Yeah. And now I am sending a whole lot of other people to go do this. And I was like, you know what? I probably need to stop doing this.
Yeah. And I think that once you realize that for yourself, what you do from that point on is a determining factor of the kind of person that you are and the kind of person that you want to be, you know? So people are people. It's unrealistic for me to think that people aren't going to clap back, aren't going to, you know, come full force for people, but I just want them to, for a split second, just think about why you're doing it. If you still want to do it, go ahead and do it, but don't let it be a thoughtless thing.
Yeah. The learning experience for me is actually now, I guess like 6, 7 years ago, but I saw some dude dressed crazy. I was out to brunch and he did look ridiculous, right? So I took a picture of him looking ridiculous and I put it on Instagram because I used to put pictures of ridiculous things on Instagram.
Yeah.
This was simply another thing I had encountered in my life
that
I thought people would find to be entertaining.
Yeah.
That dude saw it at his table. My table is like across the way.
Oh, no.
And now we're going back and forth on our phones in the same place, mind you. And I did tell him, I was like, yo, you laugh when I did this to other people. Now you got a problem when it's you, right? Which technically correct.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily make me right.
Yeah.
Eventually had to block him. It got real bad there. But then I had to stop and realize, oh, there are people who are actually like in these pictures. Somebody hit me on that and was like, well, why'd you do it?
Yeah.
And I was like, you got a point there, buddy.
Yeah.
You got a point.
Oh, God. That gave me anxiety just thinking about that.
I saw it. I was just like, oh, ain't that something? Like, that wasn't that level of anxiety I had once to do Josh Hamilton. He's a baseball player. He had a very heartwarming tale of overcoming drug addiction that to me, called out some of the hypocrisies in sports coverage. And I did a radio show that was largely based around the concept, what makes one crackhead different than another? And then his dad called. And that is maybe the most anxious moment I've ever had like in my life. His dad was very cool about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one thing about it is it's kind of hard to deny it. He was smoking crack.
Yeah.
But that, you know, but I was like, oh, which way is this going to go? And that was once I put that dude in his ridiculous outfit on the Instagram. It was just like, nah, maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to leave this alone.
Yeah.
But they didn't mean to pass at all. I wanted to ask you this, though.
Yeah.
Writing about family and your parents, how has that been for them, as far as you know?
They haven't read it, and I don't want them to. My mom, she's a nurse, and the people in her office read it, and they're like, oh, my God, your daughter's a great writer. And she's like, am I a bad mother for not reading it? I was like, no, you're a perfect mother. Do not read this. Don't read it. I don't want them to read it. My siblings, my sister said that she wasn't going to read it because we had different experiences. You know, I'm 6, 8, and 10 years older than my siblings. So the parents that I had are not the parents that they had. My parents, you know, were full-time students working full-time and trying to parent this, you know, weird kid that didn't sleep and, you know, was very emotional. Like, it was a different experience that they came up with. So, you know, they respect that and they understand that there were things that they don't want to say, well, that didn't happen, because they don't know. They were young or they just didn't have that same experience. And they're very respectful of that. I sent some early stuff to my brothers because I wanted to, again, gauge how much kindness I was offering. And they were like, you know, take this part out. Don't say this about dad. Don't say this about mom. And I was like, okay, I see you, because I don't want to just be vicious. But I would really like for them not to read it, or I would want them to wait until like I could hand them a check for like $100,000. Like, all right, you can read it now.
Fair trade.
But look, I bought the house for you.
Well, I wonder if you feel that they are missing out on some of the understanding that the readers were able to get, and maybe they, and, you know, and I'm not in a position to know how many of these things you would discuss with them before, you know, just generally speaking, before the book came out. But I feel like we were granted a certain access to you that may be beneficial to them and to you as a result.
I think had I written this about 15 years ago, I would agree with that. Because there are things that I would want them to know in order to help them understand what I was going through. I think at this stage, it's not important for them to, because there's nothing they can do. And knowing my family and knowing my parents, I think that they would live in the past too much, and they would feel guilty about things that they shouldn't feel guilty about. My parents are immigrants from Nigeria. They are not going to see the perspective that I was offering. They'll just see it laid out flat, and I just don't want them to do that. And there are things I don't want them to know. You know, I don't want them to know some of the things that I did when I was at my worst. I don't want them to know or feel ashamed or responsible for it. I don't think that the people who are very close to me are able to remove themselves from the book enough to see it clearly. I've had friends, again, who, you know, there's an essay where I think I'm awake for 24 hours and I hadn't slept for days, and a friend of mine, you know, called me and was like, go to sleep. And I was like, what are you talking about? He said, well, I can't tell book bossy to go to bed, so I'm telling you that you need to go to sleep. Like, just go. Like, I, you know, stuff like that. I don't want people to feel like they need a time machine or wish that they had a time machine. I don't want them to live in that.
That essay was a master clinic, by the way. That was one where I was going through it and I was just like, yo, this is really, really good. Like, you know, and I guess that was where my sister, she writes fiction. And I recall that she had a professor who was a poet, and she talked about how the impact of each word in each sentence is what you learn as someone who, what you learn from a poet when you are not writing poetry, right? It's just how to do that. And that was my thought. Like, after I found out after reading that stuff, that poetry thing had been your bag. And so it was like, oh, this makes perfect sense, because every single sentence just nailed it. Like, that was some jealousy inducing.
Well, thank you for that. It's actually going back to the editing process. They wanted to chop that in half. They said it was too long, and they wanted to edit like a good a good half of it out. And I said, either it all goes in or none of it goes in, because it is very precise. And I wanted the portion that they wanted to take out where people are exhausted, like they can't go through this. I was like, that's it. That's what I want people. I want you to be so exhausted with me that you can put the book down and walk away and come back and pick it up. But the person in the book can't do that. And I want you to understand that. So, I appreciate that. It's one of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah, like, what's it like arguing with the editor about that? Because, like, I'm generally a whatever you say with the editor type of person, but I also don't write about me. And yeah. Right. And so, like, you know, you said before that, you know, it's not really hacking, it's making it better. But at the same time, it is somebody telling you how to frame a discussion of your own life.
Yeah. But you got to know better. You know better in certain aspects. So my editor, I love her to death. She's fantastic. But she's this, you know, white woman who has like a very specific past. She's much younger than she's younger than I am. So there are things that there's a part in the book where I think I'm writing about one of my ex-boyfriends, and I said he thought you was magic, and she kept like flagging it, like, you are magic. I don't know, this is very you was like, this is very specific, like, it has to be was, and I'm very, very firm about stuff like that. The things that I'm not firm about, I'll juggle and I'll weigh, and ultimately I'll follow my instincts, but I'm also I also know when my instincts aren't working for me, and that's when I'll pay attention to them, and that's when I'll try to understand you know, where they're coming from. I'll consider everything. But what I change is up to me, you know.
She would too.
Yeah, she
okay.
Is.
I was just checking. I was like, hey, yes. Okay, we got you. I was about to say, you know, that work here. And I'm like, okay, she don't work here at all.
Yeah, she's with me.
All right. So where do you go from here?
Where do I go? I guess I can announce it because it's online. I just signed with UTA to possibly turn the book into a TV show or a film.
Sorry.
I'm leaning towards TV. I'm also thinking about book two and book three. I think that there's I wrote this book again like it's the only book I'm ever gonna write, because you never know. Yeah. Like, it could have flopped. It could have been,
I mean, it really might be the only book you ever write.
Like, and I'm okay with that. No one else is okay with that. They're like, no, you gotta write more. And I'm like, I'm good with being a one-hit wonder.
Stay black and die. That's the list.
It's like, thank you so much. I hit it. I'm good. I don't want to write another book and then it do so terribly that all they remember are how terrible, you know, how bad that one book was. What's happening?
Are you enjoying it? Like, all of this that's come after, are you enjoying it? It's best, like, New York Times bestseller.
Yeah. I am. I think that, I've worked so hard for so long, and there was a decade of nothing. There's a decade of me struggling financially and emotionally and mentally and trying to find a way to get myself together. So this happening now, when I am the healthiest I've ever been in my entire life, and I'm able to really appreciate it, and I'm able to see, able to appreciate myself and realize that I have done something that I don't have to, debate with myself about how good it is or how well I did or if I could have done better. I always think I can do better, but I'm having a really good time with it. I'm very grateful for the response. I'm very grateful for the people who have supported me from day one and watched me struggle and are now having more fun with it than me. My best friend since the eighth grade has watched all of this go down, all my ups and been there for a lot of the downs and watching how excited she is when things happen and watching my parents, you know, feel like finally they don't have to worry about me as much as they have in the past. Like, I like it.
Right, that's dope. Smiling and everything. That is fantastic. Now, yeah. That is Bossy Igpe. I want you to check out the book, I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying. We actually have worked something out with the publisher. We're going to give a couple copies away of this.
Dope.
So if
okay.
You guys can follow the hashtag The Right Time on Twitter or Instagram, we'll figure it out. But we're going to give a couple of copies away. And again, I'm telling you, man, this is a monstrous piece of work. I really, really... And say, you guys who know me know I don't tell people to do stuff very often. So I am saying to you guys, please go check this one out. It's a good one. I think you will definitely enjoy it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come into to our fancy here studio and hang out with us.
Thank you for asking me. I'm really happy to be here.
Right. And throw your brothers a shout out since they might be here.
Okay. Hi, Jason. Hi, Kebe. You're on the Womani Show.
There we go. There we go. I didn't even get a chance to start asking some of my, I lived in Nigeria for a year questions.
Did you really?
Yeah, we did when I was very, very small. We lived in Nigeria for a year, which allows me just enough of a fascinating insight to you fascinating people.
Wow. How young were you?
I was like 3, 4, somewhere
okay.
in there.
Okay.
But old enough.
Yeah.
Old enough to figure out that we playing a little bit of a different game here.
Yeah.
You guys are fun.
Yeah, we're something. I'm going to be back at the end of the month. I haven't been there in about 4 years, and I was spending a lot of time there a couple of years ago. And I told everyone, I think I tweeted it. I was like, I'm going back as a tourist. I have my blue passport. I'm not going back as a Nigerian because I refuse.
A friend of mine, she's Nigerian, and she told me this is maybe the best way I've ever heard it put. She's like, for better or worse, Nigerians are the most exceptional people in the world.
For better or for worse.
<That's> say, which, whatever we're talking about,
yes.
Nigerians are exceptional.
Yes.
In whatever degree, the magnitude is exception, whichever way we're going on
yes,
the circle.
Yes, that is a perfect way to put it, and I'm going to have to steal that because that is so accurate.
All right, that is Bossy Igbe. Check out the book, I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thanks to our sponsor, Butcher Box. Be sure to check out the Bill Barnwell Show. He and a guest will preview week 6 of the NFL slate. Download and subscribe to the Bill Barnwell Show. Also, check out The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.